From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Kate Bullock's book, Spinster, she is constantly finding inspiration in books and articles she manages to find. In one such encounter, she picks up a book in a used bookstore where a woman, an essayist and a journalist like she is, describes her decision to leave her marriage and set out on her own. This gave Bullock a kind of startling realization that she's never actually been alone. Sure, she had been independent and ambitious, but never truly alone, and she wondered, who was she on her own? That's one of the questions Bullock explores in the book, and today in the program she's joining us to talk about it, about women living their lives, organizing their life choices on their own terms. Join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Right up front in her popular new book, Kate Bullock lays out the two questions she says define every woman's existence. And it doesn't matter where she's raised or what religion she practices. In fact, it doesn't matter if she's religious or if she's gay or determined never to get married. Two questions define her, govern her: whom to marry and when it will happen. Kate Bullock's book is called Spinster. It's probably heard of the book by now, where she explores what it means to be a single woman in a society that still thinks there's something wrong with that. There are more than 100 million American women who are single, and Bullock writes about it as a choice, living life on your own terms. Though it's not a social science piece packed with statistics, it's a memoir. It's really personal. Her own experience with a single life and the women who also made the same choice. And today in the program, Kate Bullock is joining us to talk about it. Again, the book is called Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Kate Bullock is a journalist, a cultural critic, contributing editor for The Atlantic, and she's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York. And Kate Bullock, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I wanted to begin for just a moment with kind of what was the first incarnation of this book, of this story. It was the cover article you wrote for The Atlantic. It's been several years ago now, 2011, and it got a lot of attention, caused kind of a stir. But I wanted to ask you about it because I think it's interesting how the idea has sort of evolved since then. Do you mind telling me what was the original assignment? You've talked about this because it was kind of different from what the book ended up, it seems.
Well, yeah. So the original Atlantic assignment was, Kate, will you look into changing marriage trends and how men's worsening economic prospects because of the recession are changing the future of dating, marriage, and the family? Right. So that was the original assignment I was given. And they said, write it in the first person, drawing on your own experiences and as an unmarried woman of 38, turning 39 at that time. And I said, sure, that sounds like an exciting story to do. So I started doing the research and reporting, and I was fretting the whole time about how would I talk about contemporary marriage trends and the economy in relation to myself, because the reason I am an unmarried woman has nothing to do with men's worsening economic prospects.
Right.
And then I came across the statistics around single people that those statistics just weren't as public at that point in the public ether. And I was shocked to discover that I was part of an enormous demographic shift of more single people in America than ever before. And so that's what I turned the story into, was more of an exploration of that phenomenon.
What was the reaction to the article? Because it's something you said that it gave you this kind of this weight of expectations that now you, Kate, were supposed to moderate this big, massive discussion.
Right. Yeah, I did not feel equipped to do that. I mean, I wasn't equipped. I had learned a lot in the 7 weeks that I had researched and reported the article, but that's all I knew. And I'm really wary of spokesmanship, I guess. It wasn't a role that I wanted to fill. I'm a very questioning kind of person. I'm more interested in questions than answers, I suppose. Yeah. So I did feel that that did color my writing of the book itself, the kind of weight of a certain expectation. But I think of the book in certain ways as a prelude to the article.
Yeah.
Because when I was writing the article, these women who I write about in the book were front of mind for me. I was started thinking about them a lot. And I mean, I'd always been thinking about them, but I'd pushed them to the side for several years. And so after there was such a big response to the book, I mean, to the article, and it went viral and all that, and I started getting all of this email from people wanting advice about how to live their lives. And I thought, well, I guess that, you know, I tried a version of this book in 2006 and I couldn't do it. And maybe I can try doing that now. So that's what I tried to do.
Yeah. It's so personal. It is a memoir, beautifully written, obviously, and it tells these terrific stories, but you really are vulnerable in it. Had you intended that? I mean, I guess did you figure you needed to really be honest about your life, your personal life, to be able to tell it right?
Yeah, and that was harder than I thought it was going to be. I had this idea going into the book that, of course, I'll be in here, but this is not a memoir with a capital M.
Yeah.
I'm just using my personal experiences as a way of grounding the reader, kind of guiding the reader through this history that I find so interesting and these women that I want to write about. And I'll do that at a remove. We don't need to know too much about me. I'm not particularly interesting, et cetera. But then I turned in the first draft of my book, and my editor said, "This is great. We just need more you.
Right.
here. And so I kind of backfilled the book with enfolded in stories from my life. And I saw absolutely that she was right, that needed to happen, that if without my story, the stories of the women read like five not connected potted biographies.
Yeah. There's this story you tell. I mentioned this in the introduction, how you were browsing at this used bookstore and you pick up this book by a woman named Vivian Gornick. And, you know, she's really similar to you in some way. I mean, she's a critic and she's a journalist. And she had written about this decision to leave her husband and to just live on her own. And she writes that solitude was a gift. And you write about in the book, and I wanted to ask you about this, because you say this really had a profound effect on you. Would you talk about finding, encountering that book and reading it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Vivian Gornick is an excellent writer about solitude and loneliness. And when I first, you know, discovered her, that was around the year 2000. And it was at the time there were still so few people, women particularly, writing about that topic. And to read her essay and that particular essay and then the rest of her work and the kind of, you know, clarity and nuance with which she treated the topic was very energizing for me and helped me clarify that being alone was something that I was curious about and wanted to do, and that I felt that for myself. I wouldn't really learn how to become an adult until I knew how to be alone and take care of myself.
Yeah.
And it was her words really helped me.
What did you mean by this? This was interesting because you say no matter how independent you felt or how ambitious you were, that deep down you knew, at least then, that you had this escape hatch. You know, you could, if it didn't work as a writer, it didn't work as a, you know, an editor, you could get married and have kids. And men didn't really have that same kind of escape hatch. Would you talk about that and how you're feeling about that now? I mean, how you put yourself in that place where you, in fact, don't have that as an escape hatch?
Yeah, well, so, you know, when I was feeling that, it was the year 2000.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, that's one of the tricky things about this book is because I'm speaking somewhat to the contemporary moment, but also talking about 15 years ago and even 20 years ago. But yeah, very much in the year 2000, I was 28 years old and everybody I knew was either married already or about to get married. And I just didn't feel ready for it yet myself. I figured I'd do it someday. Someday I would feel ready. But not then. And I was surprised given that, you know, I studied some women's studies in college and was raised by a feminist mother and was very aware of the second wave of the women's movement. And I was surprised that here in the year 2000, there wasn't more of a conversation about what an unmarried life would look like, because that conversation had been very present in the 70s. And, you know, Vivian Gornick was writing out of that time period. And so here I was living in this different time period. So it's the future. It's 30 years later. But it was actually a more conventional moment. And the, you know, matrimania was ascendant. And just everybody, marriage was everywhere. And it's what everybody assumed that they would do without question. Yeah. And so, yeah, like I wanted to try to be on my own. I wanted to live on my own, see what that was like. I wanted to try to be a writer, which I knew would be very hard. But in my low moments, when it felt like it was too hard and I would never be able to make it, I would think, oh, should I have never left my small hometown? Should I just still be there and be married and have children right now? You know, did I make a big mistake striking out? And so there was always that shadow life of the life that I should have done, that life I should have led was haunting the life that I was actually trying to lead.
And 15 years later, how are you thinking about that?
Well, now I see that I was trapping myself in this false dichotomy between single versus married and just terrorizing myself with it. And, you know, and it took me 10 years to realize that. And to it wasn't until my mid-30s that I realized, oh, wait a minute, you know, I still haven't gotten married. And I really like my life the way that it is. And I have made these choices unconsciously.
It's that false binary, which we'll come back to, actually, because that you write about in the latter part of the book.
Yeah.
But there are these five women. I don't know. I keep thinking there are six, actually, if you count your mother, that you write about. These women who are models for living the single life as a woman, even though not all of them stayed single all of their lives. But how do you describe your relationship with those women? Because in the book, you describe it at one point as these conversations you were having with them.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think of them as my imaginary friends.
Yeah.
In a way, I also think of them very much as, you know, it was through them that I created a conversation that I needed, the kind of conversation that I used to have with my mother before she died. Mm-hmm. And just that kind of, you know, my mother and I were quite close. And if she had lived, she would have been the person I would have been discussing my life with and the decisions that I was making. And without her, I didn't know who to talk to. So these women that I started finding in history and attaching myself to became these interlocutors and almost maternal figures, because they were older than me. They had gone before me. They gave me a sense of perspective and enlarged my sense of self. It made me feel less caught in my own little narrow sphere of ignorant experience.
You call them your awakeners. And that's a word you got it from Edith Wharton.
Yeah. So she uses it in her memoir to describe the books and people who influenced her own intellectual journey. Mm-hmm. And I really like the word because of how it stands in opposition in my mind to the word heroine. And these women I write about weren't my heroines. They weren't my heroes. I wasn't trying to be them. I think of heroines as being larger than life, showing us possible, you know, ways of living that are beyond our own abilities. And they're kind of superhuman. Heroines are their heroes.
Yeah.
And awakeners are people who just show you other ways of being, who you're not trying to copy, who you're not holding them above you so much as looking at them as equals to some degree. The reason that feels so important to me is because I was trying to engage with these people in conversations through their works, you know, through their biographies, through the works that they wrote and the works written about them, would create this internal conversation in my mind. And if I was thinking of them as heroines, I would have not been conversing so much, but instead just asking them questions and hoping that they would give me answers.
Right. The connection is so interesting, too. I mean, four of them, at least the native-born ones you point out, had ties to New England like you did. Four of them were redheads. And there was this point you mentioned in the book that I really liked where you say you came to see all five of these awakeners. And we'll talk about who they were as we go, obviously. But you started to see them as this one group, which kind of gave you this connection to not only a future but a past. Because this is this kind of insight you get to at this party you hold for yourself at your 40th birthday. Would you talk about that moment? Because you talk about it as a kind of shift in your perception.
Yeah. So I had been collecting these women who had lived unconventionally around the turn of the last century. I had been collecting them as a habit over time and talking to them in my head, as I've said. But I'd always thought of them individually. I didn't think of them as a group until, yeah. Until suddenly I was. I started thinking, like, wait a minute, there are these five women I have gathered around me and who have really brought me all this way. I'm turning 40 and, I lost my mother at 23 and they had filled in that gap, that, you know, kind of done some of the work that she couldn't since mm-hmm. she was gone. And seeing them together as a group, thinking of them in relation to one another, really gave shape to the last, 17 years of my life in a way that I hadn't thought about before. I'd always been so future oriented. You know, I think youth or young adulthood is so much about who am I going to become? What am I doing? What will I be? Trying to shape a career, a life, et cetera. And for the first time, turning 40, I saw, it was such a classic moment where you feel your mortality in a new way. And I was able to see that I had this past as well as a future. And it made me feel much more introspective. I mean, I'm a very introspective person, but it made me want to go look more in depth at these women and who they were and what they'd been to me mm-hmm. in a more conscious way.
We should explain, your mother died. You were 23. And really, it's with her, you say, is where the story begins. And you tell this story of the fact how your mother had said to you that when she was a young girl, she would lie in her bed and she would try and conjure the man that she would marry. But what's so interesting about that story is that, she never really described being married or getting married as this oppressive thing. And it's interesting. That's true of, I think, a few of the people, your awakeners, that it wasn't really ideological for them. It wasn't really political. They didn't see the single life. Some of them did, I guess, but not as a piece of activism, just the way they lived their lives. And I'm wondering if you saw that in your mother as well.
Yeah, I mean, my mother was very happily married. And so, it's interesting to, first of all, I mean, when we were talking earlier about this book being more personal than I had expected, I did not realize that she was going to be a part of this book until I started writing. And it was kind of distressing to realize that I had to start with her. And
wait, why?
I was really...
Because it was so personal or just because that seemed like that's what everyone would do or something?
Yeah, partly. Yeah. I mean, I wanted this to be a book about my 30s. I wanted it to be an adult book. Yeah. I didn't want to be writing about my 20s. But I realized I couldn't even begin to write about my adult self until I was addressing this most formative experience in my life, which was losing her. And that's when my life as I know it now really began, was with that loss. So... Yeah, it felt a little cliched, like a little, as I even say in the book, like I was asking the reader for this kind of easy sympathy. Them's there, the facts. That's how it worked out.
And, right.
But I was, although my mother was happily married and happily a mother to myself and my younger brother, I also felt very strongly the tension that she felt between her ambitions to be a writer and the demands of, of family life. And it took her a long time to start getting closer to what she wanted to do. And that, so for her to die unexpectedly of breast cancer at 52 and have her life cut short right when she was still at the beginning of really feeling her own power, that imbued me with this conviction that I needed to start right away. And I couldn't put off what I wanted to do or my own ambitions, that I needed to pursue them for myself and also for her.
Kate Bullock is with us. Her book is Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. We need to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back with journalist Kate Bolick. We're talking about her book, Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. She's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York. Let's talk about Maeve Brennan, who's great. In fact, she's the patron saint of your story, I think you put it that way.
Yes.
And I love the story where you find her. You're thumbing through this magazine sort of just absently, and you come upon this big portrait. And what's stunning about the portrait, and I've seen it since, is, in fact, how much she does look like you. And that struck you, too, obviously.
I'm glad that you saw it that way as well.
Tell about because that's where it started, was the image. Like, whoa, that looks a lot like me. But then you really dug in, and she became really important.
Yeah, so I think I was around 26 when I found Maeve. And I was working as an assistant at the Atlantic Magazine back when it was in Boston. And a couple of Maeve Brennan's books had just been reissued, and there was a feature about her in The New Yorker and this big photograph. And it really did, I mean, in my memory, as I write in the book, the magazine just springs open, and there's this portrait, and I am looking at myself, except a little older. And I think she was actually 34 in that picture. Mm. So I was looking at a version of myself older, but also living in the past. The photo was taken in the 1940s. And she had this look in her eye that I wanted so badly. She looked so in possession of herself, so autonomous, almost glowering, but not right. quite. There was a very understated elegance and glamour, not a showy or fancy glamour. It wasn't this wasn't a fantasy lady or something. She looked She looked very realistic, but just like with elegance and taste. And I wanted it. And it was the first time I thought, like, that's the grown up I want to be. You know, at the time at 26, I just felt like this, you know, kind of, you know, grief stricken, lost young person without an idea of really where to go. And seeing Maeve and then just reading her works really opened up a whole way of thinking. And her voice, it was the first time I had read a woman writing in the first person about herself, but not in relation to somebody else.
There's a section in the book about this. Would you read this for us?
Yeah, sure. That year, 1998, was the height of the memoir boom, evidence of which streamed through the office on a daily basis, some of it compelling, much of it horrible. But even at its very best, when a woman was able to present herself with honesty and intelligence, her experience was inextricably bound to the people around her, as if her story didn't exist apart from theirs. It was different for men. They knew how to present themselves as singular agents, even heroes. Maeve was the first woman I'd ever read who wrote about herself not in relation to someone else, whether lover, husband, parent, child. She simply walked around New York City alone, watching. Her point of view was as clear and contained as an ice cube. Walking through Washington Square Park, she watches a couple on a bench fighting just before dawn. From a hotel room many floors up, she watches an old woman dropping a letter out the window, one page at a time. On the A train, a man offers her his seat. She politely refuses and then spends the rest of the ride anxiously regretting her refusal. Here, of course, she is watching herself. That last one was my favorite. I'd always been daunted by New York City, cloaking my provinciality in smug disinterest, as if the small towns of my close acquaintance were world enough. Brennan's short scene on the subway was a chink in the great wall of my resistance, and when I peered through, I saw that New York wasn't merely the dense, brutal megalith I'd feared, but also an unpredictable, infinite chain of human interactions, each a tiny drama that flared into being as quickly as it disappeared. A longing to leave Boston welled up in me like a flood. I wish I could say I brought the book home and read the whole thing in one night without getting up even for a drink of water, and the next day bought a bus ticket to Penn Station. The truth is, it took a while.
Well, it did take a while, but eventually you got there, right? New York City.
Yeah.
It was interesting that you write that when you were able to place yourself in her point of view, in Maeve's point of view, that you were able to forget yourself. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, that she was so observant, and she was so, you know, keyed into what was going on and around, all around her all the time, that, and again, you know, coming from where I was, just, you know, grief is such an all-consuming, self-absorbed emotional state. And so something, I could sort of pretend that I was Maeve and walk around and walk down the streets and look at things the way Maeve would look at them. And it, or how I thought that she would look at them. And it really lifted me out of myself and helped get me re-engaged with the world. And just also start to think about myself in terms of being a human who is her own self in an essential way, not, you know, as well as connected to other people, but yeah, that there was a self beyond my relationships. So, you know, I just beginning to sort of scratch the surface of what that might be for me.
She was born in Dublin in 1917, I think it was, you say. She comes to the United States when she's a teenager. And I guess we should explain. I mean, she writes this piece for The New Yorker, this column, The Long-Winded Lady.
Yeah. Yeah, so she wrote that column for about three decades at, you know, sort of mid-century. And so her pen name was The Long-Winded Lady, and it was just Maeve wandering around the city describing what she saw. And throughout that in her – well, maybe I'm getting ahead of the story. I don't want to get ahead.
You know what's interesting? I loved the part where you wear her perfume.
Mm.
I wanted you to talk about that because it was almost as if you had mentioned, at least in the writing, that you were actually wearing that perfume. This was a Chanel perfume, and you were actually wearing it still at the time. I'm guessing you probably still do from time to time. But what was it about that?
Oh, you know, so you know, it was 1998 when I first learned about Maeve, and then she sort of went dark. You know, I read her books, but there was no biography of her. She was not famous, and she was a fairly obscure figure. So I didn't learn anything else about her, and I was desperate to know more, especially now that I was in New York, where she had lived for so long. And then her biography came out. I think that was in the year 2003, and I was, it was so exciting that I was finally going to get to learn about Maeve's real life. And to learn the material details of her life was very satisfying. I'm someone who's very keyed into my own environment. And so you know, so as soon as I read that she wore this Chanel, Russian leather is the particular scent, I called up the Chanel publicity office and I decided I'd do a story on signature scents for a women's magazine so that I could order different perfume samples and try them on. And so when that box arrived and I opened up the bottle and smelled, I just couldn't believe it, that I was smelling what Maeve had smelled like, because she wore that perfume every day. And was really known for it. And in the halls of The New Yorker, it kind of wafted behind her as she was walking through the office. I love that it brought her to life for me. It made her more tangible, just to give me a tactile relationship with who she was. And I'll say, you know, it took me a long time to try to wear it myself because I thought of it as Maeve's perfume. Yeah. So I just had it sitting on my bureau, and I would kind of look at it and sniff it every so often. But it was like having Maeve in my bedroom.
It's interesting, the end of her life, there's this kind of, it's really sad. She is stylish and always self-possessed, but she has mental illness, and she becomes kind of the cat lady that you, I mean, it's a really sad end. She was mentally ill, though. So what do you make of that part of it? Because you do write about this part of her life, obviously.
Yeah. So I was, you know, reading the biography, I was so saddened to learn how sadly her life had ended, that for the last, you know, 15 or 20 years of her life, she just started slowly losing her mind and ended up actually a bag lady on the streets. Cut off all of her friends. Everybody tried to help her, and slowly, you know, she just pushed them further and further away. And it's an absolutely tragic end to such a strong, brave life. Given that I'd been idolizing her for so long, it also scared me. Like, good God, you know, I've been glamorizing and idolizing the way that this woman lived, and look how she ended up. Am I going to wind up like that? You know, what does it mean to risk yourself to live a life that isn't set up with safety measures?
Yeah.
And but I came to see her end differently. I see it less tragically now. I see that she, I mean, with inarguably, she struggled with these mental illnesses that made were particular to her own self. But she also continued to live in a very engaged way, living always on her own terms. And what I was so lucky to find, a friend of hers, Maeve's, one of her very last friends, and this woman does not appear in the biography. She emerged later. And so I got to find out about this whole hidden chapter of Maeve's life, where she'd been, had lots of women friends and was going to artists' colonies and living very vibrantly, that it hadn't, the path hadn't gone dark as I'd feared, as early as I'd thought.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting turn. That was the kind, sort of the new insight about her life. I think that may make people rethink the end part of her life, because as you said, she had these, yes, she struggled with mental illness, but she had, there was something really engaged about that last part of her life. And friendships with women, which is significant, because she didn't really have that in her early days.
Yeah, and that's a lot having to do with the historical moment in which she lived, that being an unmarried woman in the 1950s. That, you know, I like to say that's the second worst moment in American history next to the Salem witch trials, to be a single woman. Only 17% of women were unmarried. That was when the stigma was at its greatest. And women were, friendship wasn't prized or celebrated the way that it is today, female friendship. This was pre-second wave of the women's movement. Women were, you know, it was a very different time. It just, and especially working at a place like The New Yorker, where it was predominantly male, the few women who were on staff, you'd think that they would band together and become friends, but really they were competing for the same small space. And so they didn't find a sense of sisterhood with one another. So it seemed in that way, and on the friend level, Maeve had led a somewhat lonely life until her later years, when she started to make these women friends. And this was in the 1970s and 80s. And so I came to see not only that she had lived much more fully than I had thought, but that she in fact was living out a kind of, she was a prototype for the kind of urban way we live today that's become much more common, that she was prioritizing experiences and observation and writing and living in the world so that she was always available to learning and seeing new things and finding sustenance and connection in the webs of, you know, people that become part of your life when you live in a city. If it's the doorman to your building, or the man at the coffee shop who makes your coffee every morning, or at the laundromat where you bring your laundry, that there are these smaller connections that can really add up to a kind of richness.
There are these moments in time that you write about where you realize, and we'll go through a couple of these, women were, in surprising eras of American history, really asserting their independence and their singleness at a time when you figured that that would have been impossible for the time. Let's talk about Neith Boyce, because she's another one of the awakeners. First, tell us a little bit about how you first sort of came upon Neith Boyce. She was this was a book that you had gotten for Christmas, and you had learned about this amazing community, this Greenwich Village community. They were agitating for this emancipated society. Talk a little bit about that part, if you would.
Yeah, so I had no idea that there had been a Greenwich Village Bohemia before, you know, the Beat Generation.
Yeah.
So to learn that in the 1890s there had been these radicals and anarchists and bohemians living and really trying to change the world was exciting. And it just so happened that I was at that point going to graduate school at NYU, and so walking through every day Washington Square Park, where this was all taking place, you know, the heart of Greenwich Village. So it was that exciting feeling of, you know, the past being so immediately present. Suddenly, walking through Washington Square Park was a completely different experience, now that I could look around and spot these buildings and think about these characters and figures and to, you know, compare it against the time that I was in, you know, at that point, the year 2000. So I was very excited by this mention of Neith Boyce. So Neith, N-E-I-T-H. She was named after an Egyptian goddess. And she was mentioned in this history book. And there was also a mention of a column that she had written for Vogue magazine in the year 1898 about her decision to never marry. So I went and found that.
Say that again. We're talking 1898. I mean, that and the column is The Bachelor Girl.
Right. Right. I'm so glad that you said it. It's like, that's exactly how I felt.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I first found it, I was like, what? I had no idea. And you know, the column ran for about 8 months. And it's just her talking about the virtues of the happily unmarried life and doing it with great humor and self-assurance. And it was the voice that she was speaking in was so appealing and so different than the one that popular culture was giving me in the year 2000, where the two ways to be a single woman, according to popular culture, were either Carrie Bradshaw or Bridget Jones.
Right.
And so Neith Boyce offered me this third way. You know, there's a kind of dignity. She was really committed to her art, to her independence. And so she became, you know, I mean, that's, she also, to me, is a story about the danger of heroes. She became a hero to me, you know, the wildly independent woman of my wildest dreams. And, you know, if Neith could strike out on her own when she was 26 years old in the year 1898 and write this column for a magazine, you know, then what was I worrying about?
Right.
You know, then I could do it too. And so it really helped me get out of the long-term relationship I was in and start to live on my own. And at which point I learned that she got married just, you know, within a year of the column ending. And I was pretty devastated to learn that. But I think, you know, in that I learned a good lesson about heroes, that we shouldn't expect anybody to do the things that we're not even sure we can do ourselves.
But it also, I think that part of the book made me think about your own situation. I mean, you've been in a relationship for a while now. I think going on 3 years, unless something's changed than the last week. I mean, you don't need to say, but but it does seem odd, I think, for people to read a book called Spinster, written by a woman who's in a long-term relationship with a man.
Right.
You know what I mean? So would you talk about that? Because I think that's interesting. That, I mean, I guess why do you have to be? And that's kind of part of the point of the book, too.
Exactly. I mean, and there are a couple of ways to answer that. Like, one, it's just that was the weird, you know, luck of how life turns out that this was a topic I've been thinking about for so long. I've been wanting to write this book for so long. I got a book deal and then I met this guy and I, you know, started dating him, had no idea where it would go. And then turns out he stuck around through the whole process. And so here I was by day writing about my life as a single woman, my 30s and all my thinking about that. And then, you know, by night meeting up, you know, with this boyfriend who I was becoming closer and closer with. So it was definitely a strange lived experience. And but, you know, that said, you know, for me, what this quest has always been about is, you know, I call it at the beginning of the book, my spinster wish,
right,
that I just had a longing to know how to be alone, to be on my own. It wasn't that I wanted to stay alone for the rest of my life. And that, in fact, a lot of my longing came out of the fact that I am so social and love my relationships so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard for me to carve out space for myself, you know, apart from the people I care about. And so that's, you know, for me, you know, the word spinster and using that as the title of the book, it's that speaking to my spinster wish, the fantasy of being alone. I also like how the word immediately broadcasts are still kind of shifting and uncomfortable ideas about the single woman. It's so bizarre that we would feel that way even now in the year 2015, but we do. And then also there's something, but you know, to me, I've always been drawn to the idea of the spinster because she represents a very attractive self-reliance and autonomy and inscrutability. So we think of the spinster as alone, but who knows really? Who knows what she's doing when she closes the door on our house each night?
I wanted to ask you about, so the current boyfriend is S, but you also write about different relationships. T, I wanted to ask you about. He was a man that you, I think he was older, you met him at a lecture. And the thing that interested me about this moment in your life was you were completely blissful about the lack of commitment in that relationship. You know, it was about, at times it was just about sex sometimes, and it was just about the pleasure of being with each other. And there were times when you didn't see each other for, you know, days on end, weeks on end, I suppose, and then you would connect back up. And but then you also, I mean, it seems like you felt conflicted at that time, and I'm wondering how you're thinking about this now, this idea that you were cool with the fact, look, I'm a single woman. I don't need a man. I don't need commitment. But then you also had a sense that there was no forward momentum in that relationship and you weren't quite sure what to make of it. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. It's, you know, after a while, I started to want to define it. And it was just irrepressible, this desire to somehow label what we were doing. And the fact that I couldn't find a word for it really agitated me. And then also there was this feeling, it wasn't so much that it wasn't forward momentum, it was just was this uncanny sensation of seeing a person again and again, spending time with them, but not deepening the connection.
Yeah.
It felt like prophylactic, like,
yeah,
no pun intended.
Yeah.
Like this kind of, there was a superficiality to that. And that felt dismaying to me. I wanted to, you know, there was a lot of passion in that relationship, but not a full-hearted passion. And I wanted something more in that way.
Kate Bolick is with us. Her book is Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And we need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Kate Bolick. We're talking about her book, Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. So we're not going to get to all the awakeners, I don't think, but we have to talk about Edna St. Vincent Millay. She was an important one. And another really strong connection, at least to, like, she lived in your hometown. Would you talk about her and, I mean, her... The poem and the contest, I mean, there's a lot to talk about there, but to talk about her, the importance of her in that part of your life.
Yeah, so Edna St. Vincent Millay was, you know, the most famous poet in America in the 1920s. She, you know, won the Pulitzer Prize. She was also the embodiment of female independence. She was a single woman living in the city in the 1920s and writing poems about her romantic life, and with great bravado, and she just was amazing, a genius. And I had loved her poems when I was young, and then when I was living in New York and now newly living on my own in the early 2000s, I, you know, long story short, kind of became reconnected with her again and realized that she had grown up just a couple of hours north of me in Maine, where I had spent summers and I went to college in Maine. So geographically, we shared the same place, and that, in fact, she had lived as a child for several years in my hometown, which blew my mind to think that this person whose work I had admired so much, you know, actually lived in a house that was a 10-minute walk from the house I had grown up in. So again, it was just giving shape and a more tactile sense to my relationship with her, but also with history itself, that it's right there around us all the time. And she was, because of her reputation as a sexual, like as a femme fatale or a buccaneer, you know, I thought of her as being someone I could never be. And so I would kind of make myself feel bad about that. Like, well, if only I were bolder and braver, like Edna St. Vincent Millay, yeah, then I could weather the dating life a lot better instead of, you know, crying tonight or whatever it is I'm doing. And so it was really satisfying to go more deeply into her life and realize that, yes, she was a very bold, brave person, but she wasn't a hard-bitten heartbreaker. Mm. I guess that's what I mean. Like, I thought you had to be a heartbreaker and have a heart of ice in order to get through the dating life. And that instead, she was someone who lived with great integrity and compassion and passion and treated people well and lived very honestly. And that's what I wanted for myself, was a life that felt very honest. And so she became someone else to me. She became this sort of a compass for how to live authentically in a way that's also being respectful to the people in your life.
Charlotte Perkins Gilman, you say in the book you put her in a category kind of all her own. And on some level, you mentioned later that she really taught you the most about this, you know, your spinster wish. Say something about her, if you would.
Yeah, so she was the one who was the most ideological about it. Yeah. So the rest of the women, I'm not a very ideological person at all myself. And so that's one reason I kept being drawn to these women, is because their voices felt so intimate and I could talk to them in a personal way. Whereas Charlotte was a very politicized, radical person. She was famous writer in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and kind of a one-woman reform movement. She was involved with the women's movements going on around her, but not a huge group person. She really was a one-woman show. And she lived alone for 10 years, traveling around the country from roughly age 30 to 40. She left her husband and child. Her husband married her best friend. She and her husband had co-custody of her child. This was absolutely scandalous in the 1880s when this happened. She received so much public censure for doing it. But she knew that that's what was best and for her, and that she wanted to devote herself to bettering the world and just world building was her mission. And so she spent ages 30 to 40 traveling on the lecture circuit, never having a home. She called herself, when she would have to write her address down somewhere, she would just write "a woman at large," right, which I really liked. And she really advanced thought in terms of feminism and women and economics. And she also thought in very creative ways about architecture and the home, and that so one of the ideas that she was popularizing was the idea of the kitchenless house. So she thought, this is, years before, half a century before Betty Friedan and Feminine Mystique, Charlotte Gilman was saying women are imprisoned in their homes with all of this doing the domestic work all day long. Let's get the kitchen out of the house. Let's make kitchen work communal work. Let's make laundry communal work, and the home a domestic sphere for the family to be on, but divide them. And that notion has a lot of relevancy today, as we're seeing now new changes in the way, there's upticks in co-housing and different kinds of modern communes. And so her ideas were very prescient.
Wait, which raises this question, these kind of moments in history that some were really remarkable that I had no idea about. There's this one particular moment, this cult of single blessedness, when these women who are living, at least beginning around the American Revolution, start to assert their status as being single. There's this move by women, I think it was in Massachusetts, who petitioned the legislature to give them their own village after the Civil War. Yeah. But the last one I want to ask you about, because we're running out of time, is this moment in history about women asserting their independence through the reproductive process. And as you point out, it's the first time women really start acting on this idea that they are, as you put it, people first, women second. Would you talk about that part too? Because I loved this section of the book.
Yeah, I mean, here we are. It's been centuries in the making that, women have been bettering their own lot for a very long time now. And we're seeing a flowering like never before. The contemporary moment really began in the 1970s. That's when so many laws were passed and life was changed on in a very practical way for women. But of course, this had been going on since the first wave of the women's movement. So mm-hmm. It's a very long history, but here we are now, where women are flooding the workplace and universities like never before. They're living on their own like never before. There really is this wave that has never existed of independent women taking care of themselves. And part of this story is now with assisted reproductive technologies, women aren't bound to men in order to have children. So everything's changing. We're just in the middle of it all taking place. It's so exciting and strange.
Let me have you read something finally, if you would, because you write about finally. We were talking about this right at the beginning of the program that, you know, that there's this sort of false binary, the choice between being married versus being single, you know, and it doesn't really belong, as you say, in the 21st century. Would you read this last section for us?
Yeah. If you're single, whether never married, divorced, or widowed, you can carry the word spinster like a talisman, a constant reminder that you're in very good company, indeed part of a long and noble tradition of women past and present living on their own terms. If you find yourself unhappily coupled, you can use the word spinster to conjure a time when you weren't, and to recall that being alone is often far preferable to being in a bad relationship. Figuring out how to reclaim that happier self can offer a roadmap out. For the happily coupled, particularly those balancing work and children, spinster can be code for remembering to take time out for yourself. And if you've never learned how to be alone in a way that feels fruitful and energizing, there's no time like the present. As the never-married Sarah Orne Jewett wrote in her 1896 novella, The Country of the Pointed Firs, which remains one of the best books about the many varieties of the single experience, and here I quote, "There are paths trodden to the shrines of solitude the world over. The world cannot forget them, try as it may. The feet of the young find them out because of curiosity and dim foreboding, while the old bring hearts full of remembrance."
I love how you say in the book, being single is like being an artist. Would you say something about that? Finally, we have about a minute left.
Yeah, that it really takes being committed to your own needs and desires and figuring out how to shape your time. It takes a lot of ingenuity to live alone well. It's not as simple as, you know, finally making enough money to get your own apartment, or at least that's what I learned. And that it takes a lot of balancing between social time and alone time. Just finding peace of mind is really what it's all about.
Kate Bullock. She's a contributing editor for The Atlantic. Her book is Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. She joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. Kate Bullock, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.